Good afternoon. It's Thursday, the 21st of September 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in studio, of course, Mike Robinson. We're delighted to be joined today by Mark Anderson from American Free Press, also, of course, known as the Truth Hound. And we've got David Ellis from Strategic Defence Initiatives. We're really having a look at what is happening in the world, and we are moving ever closer to who's driving it, I think.
Let's begin with Donald Trump, because yesterday we were pointing out the schizophrenic nature of his speech to the UN General Assembly. So on one hand, talking about sovereignty and nations and mutual respect and all this kind of stuff. And on the other hand, talking about putting his country first, but the other groups of rogue stroke criminal, depraved, corrupt, destabilizing, pick your rhetoric, but it was absolutely unbelievable speech. Well, the however schizophrenic that was, the response in the media has been equally schizophrenic. So here we've got New Republic talking about his foreign policy making no sense, his rambling, incoherent speech to the United Nations General Assembly was proof that the president only has one audience in mind, and it isn't a global one. We have, just as another example, Brookings here, why Trump's strong sovereignty is more familiar than you think. And what do they have to say? From the new Gaddafi of the United States General Assembly to a disastrous nationalistic flop, early reviews of President Trump's maiden speech at the UN General Assembly have pulled no punches in 41 minutes. It oscillated between belligerence, stridency, and petulance. Trump threatened to totally destroy North Korea and asserted that some portions of the world are going to hell. So they then went on to discuss his strong sovereignty. Let's have a look at what the Financial Times had to say. Trump defies spirit of cooperation with America First message, like his Clash of Civilizations speech in Warsaw earlier this year, they say. Mr. Trump's UN address was written by Stephen Miller, a young aide who holds the torch for the American First agenda. Many of America's allies have been reassured that Mr. Trump is moving towards a more conventional U.S. foreign policy. The ejection last month of Steve Bannon, and Mr. Trump's former chief strategist, was taken as evidence of normalization. To judge by Mr. Trump's UN speech, we should not read too much into Mr. Bannon's departure. So the mainstream media going a bit nuts about this. But Brian, I have to say that looking around the so-called alternative media as well, sort of hysteria, particularly over the North Korean comments, many people suggesting that Trump is no more than a stooge, as expected. No real analysis of the speech.
I think that's a critical point, Mike. Occasionally people have said, you know, the UK column hasn't been reporting on events because actually we've been waiting to think about it and look at it and analyse what's actually happening. But we are seeing increasingly people are jumping on what's happening. They want an instant answer where the jigsaw fits in the big picture. And some of this is very complex. And I think, yes, it deserves a bit more thought, a bit more patience in working out what's going on.
So before I ask Mark for his thoughts on this, let's just bring in Sergei Lavrov, because he's on the fringes of the General Assembly meeting yesterday. And he was speaking to Associated Press and also TASS in English. The transcript of the full thing is on the Foreign Ministry website if you want to go and have a look at it. He said, regarding the statement by US President Donald Trump, it was remarkable. Some of it was probably intended for domestic audiences in addition to foreign audiences. And I think he's getting to the bottom of why it was such a schizophrenic speech. But then he went on to say that he thought Trump's speech, and especially the statement that the US stands ready and totally destroy North Korea, he was asked about that, and he said, I paid attention to another part of the president's speech when he said that he respects sovereignty and equality in international affairs, that the United States wants to lead by example and not otherwise, and that the U.S. would not impose its way of life on others and would accept the diversity of the nations, cultures and civilizations. I think it's a very welcome statement, which we haven't heard from American leaders for a very long time. Sorry. So, Mark, what are your thoughts on Donald Trump's speech and Do you think Lavrov's reading of it? Is he just looking at the thing, or is he just trying to find something positive, anything positive that he can grab hold of? Or is his analysis of it a bit more realistic?
Yes, Mike, his analysis is somewhat more realistic. I would point out that a little history is instructive here. The Korean War that created the DMZ between North and South Korea was the first full-fledged UN war. The UN was born, of course, in the waning days of World War II under some rather espionage-style things going on with Alger Hiss and others that worked for the State Department who were shown to be communists, basically. And so the situation in Korea is an outcome of UN meddling early in its life. And it's ironic that at the UN, they're talking about the very Korean stalemate and standoff that was created by the UN in the first place. That's a very instructive thing to remember. Donald Trump, on the other hand, I would just say, at least simply put, has that same dichotomy that I've talked about on this show and elsewhere before. His domestic policy sounds pretty much America first with a few wrinkles, but his foreign policy shoots off like a rocket into the netherworld, where all of a sudden he talks like an aggressor, at least with Korea. The real America First movement, which was also in the World War II days, talked about total non-interventionism, talked about not fighting in wars where the U.S. has no direct interest. So to call Donald Trump America First, like by Edward Luce of the Financial Times and people like that, is disingenuous, because the America First philosophy saw no room for interventionist warfare whatsoever. So the international globalist press is misfiring on this thing, if you'll pardon the pun. It's just not accurate what they're saying.
So this is an interesting point, Mark, because the question is, how much of this is Trump just baiting the global press, and how much of it is real?
That's a good question. He might be given the press, that part of the press that he doesn't like, gum to chew on, you might say, or a hammer to swing around with, and, you know, give him something to play with. But because he likes to antagonize the press and actually fence with them a little bit. And I don't blame him, the mainstream press, that is. I need to look at his speech a little bit more, too. I've been studying the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, a recent meeting I covered this past Friday. And you hear this similar misleading rhetoric, this, I call it globalese. This kind of almost indecipherable double talk or Orwellian doublespeak when it comes to foreign policy and these sorts of issues, global cities, foreign policy in general, whatnot. It's a whole language in itself that needs to be decrypted. And it seems like Donald Trump is being rather cryptic with his foreign policy, even though his domestic policy, maybe nix NAFTA, strengthen the border security, tax reform, infrastructure renewals, and so on, is fairly clear and rather America first. So, you know, when it comes to foreign policy is where you run into this double talk, this globalese that, as you guys say, we need to carefully sort out and not just shoot off half-cocked like some alternative media and most of the mainstream media.
Okay, thanks for that, Mark. Let's just remind ourselves, well, I just wanted to show this image which was tweeted out by the government this morning, of Theresa May leading, chairing the Preventing Terrorism or Preventing Terrorist Use of the Internet meeting yesterday at the UN Global Assembly. And, well, she's looking a bit glum there. Perhaps it's because she's wearing a snakeskin jacket, Brian, because, well, what is this?
I don't know. It is fascinating to see what they're going to wear at these events. I noticed that she's downgraded the size of her pearls in this one because she had very, very big ones on in the photos we were using yesterday.
Well, that's quite appropriate because, as we'll see in a second, the United Nations downgraded the size of the audience that was listening to Theresa May's speech. But anyway...
But can I just add, but of course, what she does overwhelmingly is she dresses... She's dressing to be the absolute Tory woman. She's well dressed, well presented. She's in the right age group. She's got the grey hair. Everybody can trust her because of this image, apparently.
Oh, really? Of wearing a snakeskin?
Well, you know, we're
anyway, let's just mention what she said in her proper UN GA speech yesterday. She said, I believe that the only way for us to respond to the vast array of challenges in the world is to come together and defend the international order that we've worked so hard to create and the values by which we stand. And it is this rules-based system that we've developed, including the institutions, the international frameworks of free and fair trade, agreements such as the Paris Climate Accord and the laws and conventions like the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which enables the global cooperation through which we can protect those values.
There you go. This is all trust me stuff. Trust me, I am a true blue Tory. I am a middle-aged woman. You can trust me.
And, she went on, of course, as Donald Trump did yesterday, to push for reform of the United Nations itself, because she was complaining bitterly that one country in particular, as we can see from her from this quote here, one country in particular has used its veto as many times in the last 5 years as in the whole of the second half of the Cold War. So she's really upset about the fact that Russia has used its veto. She was highlighting Syria, the Syrian conflict. She was a number of times talking about reiterating allegations about chemical weapons use within Syria as coming from the Assad government, and the fact that Russia had prevented action being taken on that issue. They're extremely cross about. She ended up by saying, Mr. President, throughout the history of the United Nations, countries have shown time and again that by being true to their values, rules and standards, it's possible to come together and deliver in ways that have the most extraordinary impact on the lives of the people we serve. And I just thought that was an interesting little quote, because the first question that came to my mind is, who are the people that Theresa May serves? Because it sure as heck isn't you or I.
It certainly isn't. I think we're into the realm of uncles. Perhaps we might ask David Ellis what he makes of this lady, because, of course, David's got experience of mixing in the higher levels of the Tory society.
Have you?
Yeah. I've face-to-face quite a few of them. Mark's quite right here, and I mean, you've said it over and over again. The big thing really in the question is to decrypt. I know Mark has said decrypt, but I've always said translate the language, because they're using obscure and inverse language here. So there's a few techniques you can use to do that, and probably most people just rely on common sense that you can tell what these politicians are saying is lies, because their lips are moving. But first things first, so the Cold War that was created, you know, jointly by the US isn't over. It's never been over. Nothing has changed. Let's be objective about this. The prime factors were about nuclear weapons and threats, and the nuclear weapons still exist. They continue to exist. The Cold War isn't over. It's never been over. Anybody that said that was gravely mistaken. That's just not true. So this rules-based system that May is talking about there, you know, she's sort of saying that we built and created on the one hand and an international order, and then on the other hand, we've got Russia and effectively that bloc now questioning that order and saying that the rules just clearly don't apply, because they're only applying them when they want to. So Trump, really, with all this stuff and all this rhetoric here that we're seeing from May and co, you know, she's just playing, as you're rightly saying, Brian, you know, she's playing to the Tory vote and market. And so Trump is as well. He's playing to his vote market. And that's very carefully calculated as to what they've got to say and do in order to keep on an even keel. So the last thing they want to do is use actual correct language, because what you'll have is 60% of the population will wake up and realize what's going on. So what they're saying is carefully crafted so that it doesn't do that. So the North Korea thing, you know, I mean, really, let's just sort of get down to brass tacks. What that's about is about China and this bloc. They can't talk about China in those terms, but they can talk about North Korea in those terms, about wiping them off the face of the earth. Had he said that about another country, what would be the result? So we've all just really got to be objective about that. But I've got to say that the whole thing is hinging off some very, very simple factors, because what RT picked up on, and I like their work, and I particularly liked the way that they were really coming over actually sort of unbiased. But I mean, that sounds daft for a Russian state thing. It seems like we've inverted from west to east to west, isn't it? But the the factors that are driving this, because they were, the RT were saying that he's boom and busting in terms of the bluster and the war machine and the and so on and so forth. Well, that's all about the money. So we know obviously who's controlling the money, but the rotation that causes that driver for this. So you've got energy, some sort of energy related factor, either oil or gas, drives then on the currencies, which are interlinked. They're one and the same. Oil, dollar, dollar, oil. It's, you've got to view the two as the same. So if you get problems in one, you get problems in the other. And that rotates into war machine, and that's why we're now getting this bluster. So we're seeing a rotation currently globally in those areas, and there's a lot of stuff happening in China, Russia, Iran, Syria, that are all to do with that. But we're just not getting the right amount of reporting because they don't want, you know, 60% of the German, French, English and US population to wake up and really realize actually what's going on. But yeah, we can link that into actually the war machine on the section we're going to do in a minute.
Yep. Okay. Super. Thanks for that, Dave. Now, of course, while all that's going on and Theresa May's talking about international orders and whatnot, there's another thread of the globalist agenda, which is effectively seems to be undermining, at, on the surface at least, the international order that Theresa May is talking about, and that is the Global Cities Agenda. And Mark, you were in Chicago at this meeting entitled Disruptive Forces Changing Cities last Friday, and you've described it in an article, we'll show that article in a second, as a textbook case of an elite organization pursuing a tightly planned dictatorial society while sounding like it's seeking a pristine vision of fairness, democracy, prosperity for all. You say it's being spearheaded in accordance with the growing global cities movement that's challenging the authorities of nation states around the world. And you're saying that this was announced as being an on-the-record meeting in Randolph Street in Chicago, a continuation of many of the themes covered in early June 2016 at their annual all-day forum on global cities. So give us a bit of background to this, Mark, and your impressions of the day.
Yeah, you gave a great intro there, Mike, in establishing some of the wording of what I wrote that's now on my truthhound.com blog, thetruthhound.com. What's particularly interesting, we spoke about global ease a few minutes ago, this dodgy language that they use. She named Amy Liu of the Brookings Institution, this Asian woman who was the chief speaker, the keynote. She named these disruptive forces that threaten these cities in the context of the global cities movement that you described, and we know there's a global parliament of mayors and all that. And she said they're mainly macroeconomic in nature. And she named these things, these four things, almost like they were the four horsemen of the apocalypse: globalization, urbanization, technology, and demographic change. And said that she warned, in fact, that these are upending existing systems. And then she goes on to praise free trade, saying that it accounts for about 40% of world economic value, quote unquote. And you know, she went on to say trade has this tremendous economic value because firms that export their wares hire more people and pay better than non-exporting firms, which is true in some respects. And she admitted that U.S. voters in this past election made it clear that they're not real wild about globalization. But here's the key. She went on to say, and listen to this quote, "I would say that the problem isn't so much globalization, but the failure of our public policies to help people and to help communities adjust to the new world order," quote unquote. Let that sink in for a minute. In other words, instead of creating systems that answer to human beings, Mike and Brian, these organizations are warning, that is, they want to bend human beings to the global system behind this facade of egalitarian rhetoric. And this is how this dodgy, shifty language that I call globalese works. And so she goes on talking about all these things that are disruptive to cities, globalism, globalization, and so on, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And yet those things are the very things that these organizations like the Chicago Council on Global Affairs push and advocate and get behind. the free trade system, whether it's TPP or TTIP or NAFTA, whatever, is a huge part of globalization. So on the one hand, they push these menaces, and on the other hand, they say, you know, these menaces are really getting menacing. What are we going to do? And so they have the problem and the solution in one hand and the other. It's very Hegelian in that sense. And so the more I listen to these people, the more I'm fascinated at this global ease, this doublespeak. And so, like usual, they're following up on the Global Cities Forum from last year, and now they're getting into more of the minutiae of how they would use city rule, kind of a city-state model, to kind of flow under the foundations of the nation-state and run things from the bottom up and not just from the top down. It's a pincer strategy, and they're refining it now. In terms of warning of all these disruptions, the disruptions that they themselves are largely behind. So I'm going to continue to sort this out. There's a lot more meetings coming up on this, and I'll be carefully working this out as time goes along. But it's very interesting, and it's one of the newest trends in this world consolidation movement, is to use the cities from the bottom up.
Mark, excellent analysis there. And what was I thinking while you were talking? Well, of course, we have been talking about disruptors for many years, huge amount of British government documentation, and also these large think tanks and non-government organisations all pushing the use of disruptors to get in amongst our big institutions to disrupt and destabilise them, so that in a destabilised state, in their destabilized state, these powerful forces and interests can then drive through this globalist policy. But I think you've hit the nail on the head that we'd encourage our viewers and listeners to really get interested in this subject, to the language that they're using. Too many people just listen to this stuff in the background or scan, read things. They think they understand what's being said from the words. But to understand your global ease, as you call it, you really need to think about each word in each sentence and each paragraph, because if you do that, the meaning starts to come through.
Okay, so this is the article on the Truthhound blog, if anybody wants to go and read it. Its headline is Global Cities, Elite Chicago Program Masks a Planned Undercutting of the Nation State. Mark, London, according to the Evening Standard, London has joined the fight against Donald Trump's rejection of the Paris Climate Change Deal. And when we look at the Global Cities agenda at the moment, it is the issue of climate change which is being used as the tool to drive forward with this policy. Was there any discussion of that at that conference?
Yes, Amy Liu mentioned climate change, immigration, and even foreign policy as areas where city governments would begin to get into the driver's seat more and challenge other nation states and the nations that they inhabit. So it's no surprise that London, as a city, where the mayor, Sadiq Khan, has been a guest of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs and is very good friends with Ivo Dalder, the head of the Chicago group, it's no surprise that London, not England as a whole, but London as a city, would then challenge Trump, the leader of the U.S. nation state. That fits right into the mold where the cities think that they're going to be in the front seat and shove the nation state to the back seat. Yeah. And Sadiq Khan, again, the mayor, is good friends with the Chicago branch of Chatham House.
Just briefly mention that, the Labour Party may not want the Saudis at their conference, but they're quite happy to have the cities agenda at their conference, the Centre for Cities, holding a fringe meeting, which will have Andy Burnham and Steve Rotherham, who are the two Labour metro mayors that have been elected. But just to finish this section off, I just want to highlight this article from the Centre for Cities. Collapse of Sheffield deal reflects on the government's drift on devolution, and they're really decrying the fact that the government has taken the eye off the ball, as it were, with regard to devolution. This was the day before yesterday, I think, the Sheffield City Region's devolution deal fell apart, as it were. They didn't agree to move ahead with it. The leaders of Doncaster and Barnsley chose to pursue a Yorkshire-wide approach instead, and the government isn't really pushing the agenda too hard at the moment, so they're upset about that. government's got its eyes in another in other directions, but that doesn't mean that this agenda is going away, Brian.
Absolutely not. And if I may, Mike, on that slide that you just had, it said Centre for Cities. It says there to celebrate the success of this transformation of UK city governance. Centre for Cities will bring together elected mayors. So they're crowing that they have had huge success in changing the way our society works. We haven't been asked about it, of course. This is policy that's been drifted in without our consent and largely without people seeing it as it arrives.
Yes. OK, well, look, Mark, thanks very much for that. We'll move on now. Just a quick reminder of AV 8.1 in the Connaught Rooms in London on the 8th of October, 11 to 6 p.m. Get along to that if you can. Brian will be speaking. Patrick Henningsen, Ian R. Crane and Dr. Graham Downing. And also Frumstop Wars Media on Trial event on the 19th of October. John Pilger, Peter Ford, Patrick Henningsen, Vanessa Bailey, Robert Stewart, Piers Robinson and Tim Hayward speaking at that. Get along if you possibly can. What's next?
Well, into defence, and you'd tracked this lady in a little trip abroad.
Well, this is Harriet Baldwin, who's the procurement minister, and I don't have any more details on this at this point. She was visiting her counterpart, as they've tweeted out, as the Ministry of Defence has tweeted out today, in Finland, and she's there to discuss strengthening UK-Finnish defence relations. One of the things I found a little interesting about it is that the Finnish minister there is behind a British flag and she's behind a Finnish flag.
Well, thank you for telling me that, because I was looking at her and thinking it's a very strange jacket she's got on with that unusual white and blue sleeve.
So there you go. Yeah. So I'm not quite sure if there's anything to take out of that. But
Well, I just come back to the dress, and there's the nice little jacket. She's had her hair done. She's got the necklace on. And this is all setting the scene. Trust us.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, let's move on and into the subject of what's really happening in Britain's defence. And David, you were keen that we put up some articles sort of showing dialogue over the last few years in the media. So let me run through a few things and then we'll bring you in for some comment. And after that, we're going to have a look at how some of the British senior officers, retired senior military officers, have been commenting and involved in matters to do with defence. So here we go. If we kick off with this, we've got Channel 4 here. This is back in 2007, and they had an article about what the military chief said. Now, all these people were actually complaining about what was happening with the military. This was Admiral Boyce. We've got Lord Ing here. Who's this? Lord Craig of, what's that, Radley? And, well, Field Marshal Bramall, some questions there. But at the time he was saying our military's being betrayed. We haven't got enough men. We haven't got enough equipment. And the cuts are too big. And Lord Guthrie, particularly outspoken. So a lot of material where these senior officers, retired officers, were starting to speak out. We've got the Telegraph here. August 2015, Admiral Nigel Essenhigh. Very well respected man, and he's saying that basically our defence cuts leave us looking feeble in the eyes of the world. So these are very damning comments, and they're all saying that the government is absolutely slaughtering the military, but clearly what they were saying was not being listened to. We've got Admiral the Lord West here, who's been constantly outspoken. He was also very good at parties where he was dressed as a pirate. So, but we'll take him as an admiral in this case. He said Britain needs more warships, but he reveals a plan for the Royal Navy to save our bacon. Well, I don't think the Royal Navy is going to be doing it with aircraft carriers with no aircraft. So we're not quite sure where the bacon's coming from. We've got this one here, which is the Financial Times. This is talking about Britain's withered forces, not fit to repel an all-out attack. And of course, we don't have an army anymore. We have really a sizable division of troops. This is on a World War II scale. It is quite pathetic. So this was another warning. And it brings us up to this one from The Sun. Where are we date-wise? Well, we're May 2017, no pun intended, alarmed forces, army chiefs and wounded war heroes deliver a damning letter to the Prime Minister demanding she save the forces from cuts. And if you have a look at the little embedded graph there, it is quite astonishing. We go from thousands of tanks down to 200. We've supposedly got 200 combat aircraft. How many of them are airworthy, I don't know. And then we no longer have an army. We have basically a total of about 82,000 men.
Those thousands of tanks and other armour, what became of it?
Well, this is a very interesting question, Mike. A lot of very serviceable armour was simply left behind in Iraq and Afghanistan. So as we pulled out, millions and millions of pounds of British military hardware was left because it was cheaper than shipping it back. And although we've been bringing some of our armour back from Germany, originally, of course, we had a very large British army on the Rhine, a lot of armour in Germany. As that material has come back, a lot of it is simply being sold off. Mm. So, David, the reports in the paper are all indicating that there have been senior military officers speaking out, but they write articles, they write letters, nothing seems to change.
Quite correct, yeah. Ladies and gents, well, we've had a good hard look at this now for quite some years since Admiral Woodward spoke out in 2010. With Major General Julian Thompson. So what's going on here? Okay, let's look at it objectively. Let's just stand back on our heels. We've got a lot of officers writing about defence cuts over decades and complaining about defence cuts and complaining about lack of money. And nothing has changed. The trend is still carrying on. And so we're begging the question now, having done what's known in the trade as chatter and the traffic that's gone on here with this. And what it says is it says that the shots are falling short and we're missing the mark. So what do we need to be talking about? Right. So defense cuts language and defense cuts articles are not helping because we're still cutting. And over the period that if we want to analyse this properly, hand in glove with our military and our industry in this country and our social fabric of families and jobs and so forth. From the Macmillan period, we started at about 7.2% of GDP, and that's gradually fallen now to under 2%. So what's actually going on? Well, we know for a fact what's going on is this thing called military unification of national militaries into military union. And as a direct result of that, what's got to happen is, and it's in the Lisbon Treaty, it talks about blending policy. Well, if you blend policy, you automatically have to blend and merge budgets. And then that means actually blending and merging the physical amounts of force and capability and assets and men and ships and planes and personnel. That all goes with it, because if you blend policy, ultimately you will blend the guys and girls that are serving and the ships that are serving. They'll all go into one pot. So there must have been some sort of acceptable exchange rate mechanism, the same as currency unification, to go with military unification. Now, we know there are two vital components. That's it. Full stop. They get the treasury once they get that in order to manage it. So what are these guys doing? Are they only allowed to talk about defence cuts, or are they doing it unwittingly, or what exactly is going on? Because it hasn't helped. Nothing's changed. So what I'm suggesting is that we talk about what's actually happening, which is military unification and why that is. And maybe then we'll get some traction. But until these senior officers, and I'm putting this out there, I'm going to submit this to everyone, talking about defence cuts. Yeah, which they've done a lot of that. Who has it helped? What has it done? I think it's inversely. And this is the question is, does this help the EU?
Well, David, let me come in here, because this is a fascinating subject. Of course, for virtually all these retired senior, very senior military officers, they have been in post themselves as cuts have taken place. And of course, while they were in post, none of them would speak out, because to speak out essentially meant they had to resign. and if they resigned, then they weren't going to get their knighthoods. So we can have a look at these people, and we know that when they were serving naval officers and sweeping cuts, naval officers or army officers, RAF, it doesn't matter, it's tri-service, as the sweeping cuts came through, we used to, if I go back to my service time, you could hear them talking, moaning, complaining about what was happening, but they were never going to speak out because actually their eye was on the maximum possible pension and that knighthood. Then when they retire, oh, well, they're in a difficult position because if they speak out too loudly, it just takes somebody to turn around and say, well, what did you actually do when you were serving? I've tweeted out that I regard a lot of these people as cowards, and I stand by that remark. I'm not calling them cowards necessarily on the battlefield, but socially in the higher establishment, they're cowards. Let's bring in Lord Boyce. This is a very interesting one here. We've got a slightly blurry photo, which is appropriate because his sort of policy is quite blurry. Channel 4, the Channel 4 article that we showed a few minutes ago, this is what he said in the text of part of that. The smoke and mirrors work of the government, and in particular the Treasury, actually means that the core defence programme has had no effective budget rise at all. If we were actually to cut to the truth, we would find it was actually negative. So I'm going to pick him up here because does smoke and mirrors by the Treasury mean that the government was lying? Because I think that's what they were actually doing. So this is the statement back there by Admiral and Boyce and former chair of the defence staff. We found him here on the Forces Defence Network. Now, we've been talking about this organisation because it's supposedly there to inform our armed forces, to give them a media platform, but actually it's very closely tied to government control. But here he is being interviewed. This was the question, why do we still need nuclear weapons? And this was his reply. He said, well, I think we're not very good at predicting when things are going to go bad in the world. We've been very bad at doing it over the last 3 or 4 decades, and there is every sign in this very unstable world at the moment that such nuclear powers as there are building up their nuclear weapons stocks, and it would be unwise for us to relinquish our capability at the moment. So there we are, perhaps not surprisingly, former chief of the defence staff supporting nuclear weapons. But, and this is where this really dovetails with the angle that you're coming in at, David, bring in the European Union, because here's Admiral the Lord Michael Boyce also sitting on the European Leadership Network. This is just fascinating. Now, who is this network and what are they doing? Well, here are some of the things. It administers and supports the cross-party parliamentary group, the top-level group of UK parliamentarians for multilateral nuclear disarmament and non-proliferation. So I'm a bit confused. Is this man for our nuclear deterrent, or is he working with European interests against it? We're not sure. So we've also got the European Leadership Network, sponsor of the Younger Generation Leaders Network on Euro-Atlantic Security. There's a bit of Marx globalese language coming in here, I think we can see. So if we have a look at what they're about, it says that it works to advance the idea of a cooperative and cohesive Europe and to develop collaborative European capacity to address the pressing foreign defence and security policy challenges of our time. This is the bit that interests me, non-partisan, non-profit, based in London, registered in the UK. So it's registered in the UK, but this is a pro-European organisation, and it's disseminating independent research, but it's collaborating. It's always independent, Mike.
Absolutely.
It's fantastic. Well, who's driving this? Well, you've got some very interesting names. You've got Carnegie Corporation of New York, Nuclear Threat Initiative, Ploughshares, Joseph Rowntree, the Polden Puckham Charitable Foundation. When were they invited to get involved in defence? William and Flora Hewlett Foundation. Now, in case you're suspicious about the Hewlett name, this is not connected with the computer company. That's what the foundation says. And then we've got the UK Foreign and Commonwealth Office and NATO. And if I just go through to that nuclear threat initiative before I come back to David, I was fascinated to say that one of the lead name on their page, in alphabetical order, to be fair, but is somebody from the UAE. Okay. So we've got UAE, and the next man down is a Russian. So why have we got a former admiral working with this group of internationalists, including the Russians? Because I thought the Russians were the bad guys. David, I'm confused. In my latter years, I look at these people and what they're doing. What they say does not appear to be the truth. They're not working for this country. These people seem to be working for another agenda.
Well, one thing's for certain. I mean, what can we say here? That the MPs are not talking about this. They're not debating it. It's not going in a manifesto. It's not being, you know, I'm going to knock your door as a candidate and say, will you support me in this venture or that venture to do with our military and our industry? That isn't happening. So this Tory mantra, and we go back to this language thing with Theresa May, you know, there was a mantra for decades in the Tory party about there were no votes in defence. And this was under the period when Oliver Letwin was head of policy. And I firmly believe that actually what was meant was, well, there's no votes in EU defence, so we're just not going to talk about defence at all. And this is why we've got this stalling problem with admirals talking about defence, generals talking about defence cuts, and it isn't making any difference. And I can corroborate that because all of the senior staff, chiefs of defence staff, admirals and generals, first sea lords that I've met privately, have all said they cannot find a way through. But I can accept that obviously they'll sit on groups that will overlap and there'll be overlapping groups that overlap. And one of them there that's of great interest to us, and we've covered it before, Brian and Mike, there is the Nuclear Threat Initiative with Malcolm Chalmers at RUSI and Rifkind and Des Brown, one or two other characters are in there. But ultimately, you know, what are we dealing with here? They're talking about the money. You're not giving us the money to do this. And I said this at Winchester. Well, you don't need an army, a navy, and an air force, or a steel industry, or a car industry, or any other kind of thing, if you're not going to be a nation. So they're arguing about the money. So the money is coming from the Bank of England. It's being issued and controlled from the Bank of England. It then goes into the Treasury, and then they make really the key decisions, and then they tell the officers in government what to do, and then those officers tell these would-be politicians. And nothing's changing in this relationship. And this is the principal problem. They're arguing about pound sterling issued by the Bank of England. Now, there's two things that have got to happen here if these admirals and generals want to make traction, is they need to talk about military unification and what that is and what it's doing and what it's going to do and who is going to control it. And they need to talk about money. So there is a solution to this, and Justin Walker, the British Constitution Group, has obviously articulated this in his speeches, is the solution is the government MO account, which was used during World War One, where the government issued its own sovereign national credit, along with, I think it was Vickers, wasn't it, the Deputy Director of the Bank of England at the time, and it was issued, and it basically saved this nation's bacon during World War One. So this is what we need to do. We need to reactivate the government MO account and we need to issue the Bradbury pound. And then the NHS can have their money to get on with what they're doing and the schools can have their money to get on with what they're doing and the British steel industry can have their money to get on with what they're doing and the military can have their money to get on with what they're doing because this at the moment is an utter load of tosh. It's a lie. There isn't a shortage of money. It's a complete load of nonsense. They're just damming it up like a river. And they're sending it in a different direction.
Right, David.
The direction is into military union.
Yep, David, thank you for that. And apparently we are to believe that these very intelligent, experienced former senior military officers don't know this is going on. I used to believe this, but I don't believe it anymore. They do not want to hear what is going on.
Well, there is, I mean, I put it to a couple of admirals that run Trident. So that's run in a very particular way. It's the account is run direct from the Treasury. It doesn't really go through a lot of government. They just sort of goes from Treasury, it's obviously Bank of England Treasury, straight into Admiralty, and they just sort of get on with running Trident. You know, do you know about the government MO account? No. What's that? One particularly of the brighter admirals then said, is it the military operations account? No, it's the MO account. It's sovereign national credit. It's the Bradbury pound. What the hell is that? Well, we used it in World War One. Now getting interested. So this is what's got to happen. I actually asked Lord Tebbit as well. Now, he was a cabinet minister and he didn't know about it. So it obviously was on a strictly need to know basis. So I think this is the way we deal with this problem. We talk about military unification, military union, and we also talk about the money supply, which is, you know, what's got to happen here, of course, is that the government that we elect needs to issue its own money and get on with controlling its own money and be responsible for it rather than the Bank of England doing it. Because at the moment, what the Bank of England are doing is strangling everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Schools haven't got any money. Hospitals haven't got any money. Military's got no money. Police have got no money. Fire service have got no money. It's a nonsense. It's an utter nonsense. It's like some sort of, you couldn't, you know, we've dematerialized into a Star Trek film, you know.
David, thank you very much for that analysis, which has made me smile. Mark, just as some closing words, I think I'm correct in saying that Congress has just given Mr. Trump another, is it $700 billion US dollars for defense? No money for other things in America, but this has been magicked.
Yes, it's about that, Brian. It's roughly that amount. Of course, it's the largest military in the history of the human race. It's bigger than all the other world's militaries combined. They have to borrow from now until the end of time to do this, along with as much taxation as people can handle before they begin screaming. But to get into what David is saying, and just to put a cherry on top of today's discussion, I brought up in a certain surreptitious way, I brought up monetary reform to Amy Liu at the Chicago Council Group this past Friday, the Global Affairs Council that we talked about a little while ago. And people can read about it more in an updated article at thetruthhound.com. But when I brought up monetary reform, she kind of winced. They seem to think that you can create jobs in a cash-starved economy. And what David was saying, the banks basically dam off all the money. The money supply is vastly inadequate for the health needs and education needs and other needs of society. And so when you bring up monetary reform to these people, it's like holding a cross up to Dracula. Finally, you see their true colors, and they don't want to go there. They don't want to talk about it. They dodge the issue because that's the real bellwether item here. The central banks run the world and induce a lot of the political corruption that we're seeing and induce all these shortages. So when you bring it up to the Amy Lou's of the world and other Brookings and Council Affairs people and all these people, then they kind of go,
okay.
And you know where they're at and you know where the real issue is.
Yeah. Right. Mark, thank you very much for that. Excellent discussion there. We'll just end with a big thank you to all the people that attended the UK column meeting at the George last night. One gentleman, Phil, had come all the way from Lymington. It was very good to see you all there, and wonderful to hear about what you have been doing to take on this monster. But there we are. We've heard what the silver bullet effectively is. It's to start talking about the creation of money created from nothing. When this is exposed to the wider public, we're well on our way to winning this particular battle. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. That's it for UK Column News. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.